You are listening to ANCSA at 50. The journey continues. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rhonda McBride. Think of this program as kind of a companion conversation for the 360 TV series on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which will air every Thursday night leading up to the 50th anniversary of ANCSA on December 18th. Each week, we'll look back at films and documentaries produced over the last 50 years to provide you some context and analysis for that night's TV program. This week's show is simply called The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, produced in 1986 by the Northwest Arctic Borough School District to teach students about the Claims Act, an epic fight over Native lands, a battle that escalated when oil was discovered in Prudhoe Bay, and without a settlement, there would be no pipeline.
This is Alaska, some of the most remote and beautiful land in America. But for more than 100 years, there was a dispute over who rightfully owned it. Should it belong to Alaska's natives whose ancestors lived here for thousands of years? What about the people who more recently made Alaska their home? What were their rights to the land? And how many acres should be owned by all of us, protected in national parks and wildlife refuges? In 1971, an act of Congress was passed that ended the fight over who would own most of Alaska's land. This act was the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
That voice you just heard is the voice of Nellie Moore of Kotzebue. 35 years ago, she was one of Alaska's first Native broadcast journalists and worked with Paul Unktaguk, who helped to create the study materials to go along with the video. He is an Inupiat and the former director of Alaska Native Studies at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and joins us now along with Jocelyn Estes, a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. She is of Thlinkit and English-Irish heritage. So, where do we begin? Maybe the easiest way is for each of you to tell us what you were doing in the late 60s, right at the height of the land claims fight. So, Paul, let's start with you.
I was in the middle of sort of what had become a family crisis. I was in and out of institutional and foster care at the time. So when ANCSA passed, I would have been a freshman in high school.
And what was going on in your life that you wound up in foster care?
Our mom had died when we were young. She had been ill for some time. And our dad sort of lost the bedrock with the passing of our mom. And he had gone back into becoming an alcoholic, left the military, was able to retire out. And the family just was scattered after that.
How much were you aware of ANCSA at that time, given all that was going on in your life?
When ANCSA passed, I wasn't aware of it. We had been relocated to Oklahoma with the assistance of the Bureau of Indian Affairs under their relocation program. It was tough because at that time, Oklahoma was still very much socially segregated society. And there was an intense amount of racism in the place.
I don't think people know very much about that chapter of history where Natives were relocated in the lower 48.
It was federal policy. They were trying to eradicate tribes as tribal entities, as tribal nations. And one of the ways of doing that was to depopulate the reservation areas and predominantly Alaska Native villages and communities. And one of the ways of doing that was to send people out with this promise that these brochures that would show the American Indian Alaska Native with his bucket in hand, lunch bucket in hand, as he's leaving an actual white picket fenced house and the wife waving at him, wearing an apron as they're leaving to go off to work. And of course, what was the actual event was that most Alaska Natives ended up being sent to urban areas and just getting lost in that system.
So all of that in the backdrop of ANCSA, natives already being forced from their land, pulled away from what they know. At what point did you get interested in ANCSA? You have an encyclopedic knowledge of ANCSA. I would call it Ontagukapedia. So when did that start?
Eventually what happened is our dad sobered up and had moved back to Nome on his own and was working. And once he was in a position to do so, he offered to send airline tickets. There were four boys. They were all about a year apart, sort of stair-stepped. I was the only one to accept the ticket and returning to Alaska as a high school age person to Nome. And when I got there, it was clear there was a social revolution that was happening. Alaska Natives, we had these corporations, tribes were asserting themselves, beginning to do so at a time in which Nome was moving away from being sort of pioneer Alaskan controlled to something else. And there was a lot of racial tension in the community. And it was amazing to me that this was happening. So I remember going to what became Bering Straits Native Corporation, the office, and asking for a copy of this Alaska Native land claims, whatever legislation. And they didn't have one. They didn't have one to give to, you know, some kid, high school kid off the street. And I thought, well, that's fairly disturbing because that's kind of our treaty with the United States. They should be handing these out to everyone who's got even a mild degree of interest in it. And I was only able to locate a copy of it through the office of Senator Stevens. I remember reading it the first time, and it was like trying to read calculus. It was just an amazingly challenging document. But I had tried to educate myself in one of the institutions I was in with a 1957 Encyclopedia Britannica that was, I think, untouched since it had been donated. I remember that I was reading everything about, you know, from Aachen to zygotes. Eventually, I read all of it. And I just applied that same sort of sense that the first time you read something, you just try to write questions to yourself, what you don't understand. And that filled pages. And then it was going back through and trying to get answers. And I was frightened, actually, that there were so few Alaska Natives who were in charge of what became Bering Straits Native Corporation who didn't have any of the answers to that legislation. It just flummoxed me. I thought, how can they navigate this if they haven't read it?
Well, that's a really good question. But, you know, I doubt that most Alaska Natives have read the actual legislation. Jacqueline, so where were you pre-1971 as ANCSA was being born?
Well, my family, my grandfather, Louis Paul, and my great uncle, William Paul Sr., were involved in claims very early on, starting in the 1920s. And in 1929, the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood met, adopted a resolution saying we need to fight for our land claims. And they worked with Judge Wickersham to get an act of Congress passed that gave them jurisdiction to sue for claims in the U.S. Court of Claims. I don't think a lawyer actually got on it until the 1940s. And first, they had to prove that we owned the land and the resources, and they were able to do that. That decision came in 1959, and then we sued for compensation. And in 1965, the U.S. Court of Claims said, yes, you're due something for the taking of your land, which was taken and put into the Tongass National Forest and Glacier Bay National Monument. So, you know, when we heard this, yes, we're going to get compensation, people were talking about buying seiners, you know, big fishing boats that are a huge capital investment, paying off their mortgages and things like that. We thought we were going to get a per capita distribution. I'm pretty sure it was 69. We finally got the settlement. It was not per capita. The money was to go to the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida. Meanwhile, AFN was getting going, and the president of Tlingit and Haida, John Borbridge Jr., he went to those early AFN meetings, and Tlingit and Haida loaned AFN money to pay for some of the lobbying efforts. So I was in high school in the 1960s, and then I left for college in 1969, and I didn't hear anything until after the act had been passed. And then the next thing you know, I got a check from Sea Alaska. And that first check was big, and I used it to buy my first car, and I didn't hear much about it after that. In the late 70s, I think, is when I first went to shareholder meetings. People were not happy. I don't know if this is what it was like for you, Paul, but it's an understatement to say there were dissidents. There were people who were outraged that all the money went to a for-profit corporation and all they were going to get was dividends. So because the dividends are not life-changing, they're not enough to, you know, make you independently wealthy by any means.
I think in Nome that the shareholder meetings were confusing, and there was a sense in which many people, including non-natives in Nome, thought that this was a federal handout of some sort. And it was being castigated by Nome whites as another handout to Native peoples, completely misunderstanding that from a legal standpoint, the handout was to non-Natives, because Alaska Natives were getting only a fraction of the value of the lands and waters that had been taken from Native peoples, as was standard policy under federal Indian law. The handover to Native corporations was also a source of confusion there, just trying to figure out, how do we make this happen? How do we carry this out? Because we just didn't have the kind of talent bank or people who were aware enough of corporations at all to know how to effectively develop one as an organization. The amazing thing about Native corporations is that they were formed at all, and that any of them succeeded at any level. If you would have just looked at the lack of prior preparation for Alaska Native leadership in business, the prediction should have been that none of them would have succeeded, given the circumstances. We teased for years that it was really Dire Straits Native Corporation, because it just kept going from one disaster to another until eventually it ended up in bankruptcy for a time. It took some of the village corporations in the region under with it, because they had also misspent some of the village corporation money rather than transferring it to the village corporations.
So let's fast forward to 1986, when a documentary was made, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, simple title.
The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, was the largest agreement ever negotiated between the U.S. government and any Native American group. Who were the people involved in getting the act passed? And what did it say? Was it a fair settlement for Alaska Natives? My name is Nellie Moore. We're going to look at ANCSA and how it has tried to solve the conflicts over who owns Alaska's land and how successful ANCSA has been.
This is a five-part series. Even though it was recorded at the 15-year mark of ANCSA, it's probably one of the best things you can watch today if you really want to get your arms around what ANCSA is. I really recommend folks watch this program if they want to get a good nuts and bolt look at ANCSA. But what are your thoughts about Nellie Moore's role in this?
Well, thank you about finding value in what we had tried to do, because it took a tremendous amount of effort to put together what would be the content. And crucially, it's congressional legislation, which is pretty deadly stuff to try to communicate to the general public. How do you manage to make it interesting? How do you bring the relevance of it to a general audience? And that's what we were tackling. Don Rinker was in charge of overall production. And Nellie Moore was hired because she had been at the radio station, I believe.
In Kanapeezy.
Yes.
In Kotzebue.
Right. And she was a tremendous asset to the development of the five-part series, because she was just candid about questions. Well, how would you know that? Or how did that come about? Or you're going to have to explain that again. And she wasn't afraid to just keep saying, I don't understand what you're trying to say. She brought a great sense of humor to the discussions, a sense of excitement. And she was just an even keel throughout managing all of this. I think she's just a tremendous narrator.
I think people will really enjoy watching Nellie in this series. Jacqueline, we've both worked with Nellie in various capacities over the years. What are your thoughts about seeing Nellie in this five-part series play such a big role?
Oh, it was great. And I met Nellie Moore in 1991, I think, maybe 1990. It might have been later than that. But she was a reporter for National Native News. And everything that Paul described about her intelligence and curiosity and sense of humor, they've stayed with her to this day. She was a real pleasure to work with, and I learned a lot from her. Something to mention about all of this is that there were so few Native journalists.
Of course, there was Howard Rock.
Oh, yeah, Howard. We forgot Howard Rock.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, my grandfather published a newspaper.
The point is that there were so few Native journalists, and it's so important to have that Native perspective, because most of the people reporting on ANCSA really had no skin in the game, so to speak.
Well, in fact, the major newspapers, the Juneau Empire, the Fairbanks News Miner, and the Anchorage Times were all deep set opponents to Alaska Native land claims. So you had to develop a counter to the narrative that was in the media at the time. So the role of Alaska Native journalists was not going into a vacuum. They were actually going into the lion's den, or a bear den in this case, and trying to counter the narrative that was coming across by the sort of pioneer Alaska perspective of opposition to Native claims.
And the news that was coming out in those early years was not good. I mean, Paul mentioned some of the struggles in the Bering Strait region. One of the issues is that the land was not conveyed to the corporations literally for decades. I mean, in 1991, not even half of the land had been transferred to the corporations. So the corporations were given money and supposedly given land to work with to make a profit. And without the land, they had money to invest. But for most of them, or many of them, they were not successful making a lot of money through investments.
All right. It seems like this is a good place we can take a break here. We are talking with Paul Ontagook and Jacqueline Estes here to provide us context for this week's episode of ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues. It airs on 360 TV. When we come back, more voices from the past. You are listening to the radio companion to 360 TV's ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues. Well, thank you for being here with us. I'm Rhonda McBride, and here with me, Jacqueline Estes and Paul Ungtaguk, ready to give us context and analysis of the first show in our series, a 1986 program called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So we're going to pick up where we left off. We've been listening to voices from the past heard in the 1986 documentary produced by the Northwest Arctic Borough School District. I'd like to play another clip. This one is from Willie Hensley talking about the formation of the Alaska Federation of Natives. Paul and Jacqueline, we'll get your reaction on the other side.
Individual people were working in separate areas of the state, trying to deal with their own particular problems. And as we finally discovered as time went on, we were all basically working towards the same end. And so what we thought initially was that Emil Nadi and myself and several others, we wanted to get together and more or less communicate and sort of let each other know what we're trying to do in our own area. And next thing you knew, we had, you know, 250 or 300 people in this fantastic gathering where all of a sudden it seemed like Native people from throughout the state realized that it was now or never. You know, that is, we had the opportunity to try to save something of our land and that we had to get together.
In the course of Alaska Native history, how unusual was that kind of unity that Willie Hensley is talking about?
Well, one of the things that I am struck by concerning the formation of AFN is it very likely would not have happened without the fiscal support of the village of Tyonek, who, having had a settlement of oil leases on some of their lands, had the resources to afford airfare for many of the people who came in to participate in this meeting that became the Alaska Federation of Natives. So they're sort of the fiscal founders of this statewide organization.
And the Yakima Nation in Washington also contributed money, as did the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida.
Yeah, they came, and they were crucial in that. And the Yakima fiscal support, we owe, from everything that I've ever heard, to some remarkably intelligent and persuasive leaders who were women involved with the Alaska Federation of Natives at that point.
So what made this kind of unity possible?
Desperation. I've always thought of it as there's no need to keep fighting among ourselves, the different tribes who historically have not only traded with each other, but have had fierce generations of warfare over protecting respective territorial boundaries or expanding over the territorial boundaries of other groups. We were like the Mideast in some of our history and how ferocious our defense of what we consider to be our traditional boundaries and access to areas. And that within a generation that you could move from that to this statewide organization, it really was an example of you just don't fight over furniture when your house is on fire. And that was a general sense that people arrived at. We were going to lose everything if we didn't develop some kind of unified statewide voice. Because if you were continuing to have those old conflicts moving forward, you would be divided without a voice in Congress through legislators, the state representative, and through the senators, the Alaska delegates to Congress.
And what made it desperate was that the Statehood Act gave the state the authority to select, I forget what it was, 100 and some million acres of land. And there were these proposals that were put out on the table. One was to set off a nuclear bomb near Nome to create a deep water port. And another proposal was to build a dam on the Yukon River at Rampart and create a recreational area that would have put seven villages underwater. And the state, meanwhile, was out selecting land. So when Paul said it was desperate, it was. The ground under their very feet was being taken away from them. And then at AFN, a fellow named Nick Gray gave, my understanding is that people from across the state, Alaska Natives, had met before, but had never been able to unify. And then Nick Gray gave a beautiful, eloquent speech, basically saying what Paul said, you know, it's now or never. And that's what led to the formation of AFN.
Well, it sounds like that kind of unity was absolutely crucial. And so I have another voice from the past from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act documentary from Byron Malott, who is no longer with us, but he talks about what it took to get the land claims settled.
I mean, we fought like hell. Gosh, there were some of those meetings where I can recall personally coming out literally hoarse and a lot of frustration. Because as you move through the process, you knew that for everything you did, for everything you wanted, for every draft that you did of the legislation from your perspective, that tomorrow a dozen other interests would be dealing with it from their perspective. And ultimately, it would be Congress that decided the issue.
What's it like to hear Byron say those things looking back?
Well, I think what happens nowadays, and in fact, ever since the act was first passed, people have been very critical of it. And I'm sure Byron's gotten an earful many a time about what he, quote unquote, should have done. Hindsight is 20/20, and something was going to happen. And all they could do was, it's sort of like you're about to go over a waterfall. Just keep your oar in the water and do the best you can. And so it's good to hear him explain that, because like I said, nobody really wanted the natives to have anything. The only reason we were able to get a settlement is because they discovered oil on the North Slope, and the oil companies wanted to build a pipeline across Alaska to a deep water port in Valdez. And to do that, they would have to be crossing native lands that natives owned under Aboriginal title. And they had before them the example of the Tlingit and Haida land claim suit, which had taken 30 some years to make its way through the courts. And the oil company said, we don't have that kind of time. And so the only viable solution people saw was for an act of Congress. And the state also, because of the land freeze that Secretary of Interior Stuart Udall imposed, the state land selections were halted. And so there was all this pressure from homesteaders and miners, people who wanted to have access to what would later be state lands. Those were the things that were moving it forward, were those two forces, I think.
Hearing Byron Malott's voice from 1986, looking back on the last 15 years of ANCSA, what does that make you feel, Paul?
First thing that I feel about, and when I listened to Byron Malott's speeches, what a privilege it was to share panels and sometimes to travel with him in speaking about aspects of Alaska Native issues, and hearing him talk about the enormous amount of pressure that generation faced. One of the things that we have to consider when people criticize the many shortcomings that are evident within the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is we have to remember that these are volunteers. They weren't being paid to do this. And they were facing a blowtorch of criticism from all fronts as they were moving through this process. The FBI was all over them. It was a J. Edgar Hoover FBI. They were getting all kinds of harassment and pressure and being vilified by all sides, tribal interests, pioneer Alaskans, everyone was on them. The conservationists were opposed to native land claims, and the oil companies had to be converted to the idea that native land claims would be the best possible avenue for them to get what they were trying to access. And that was no simple task either.
You mentioned the environmental interests that were in this. I don't think that often comes up in discussions about ANCSA.
Well, there's a section of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act that is buying out their opposition. It's called the D2 Act. section of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And that section promised that up to 85 million acres of Alaska would be considered for parks, preserves, and wildlife areas. That debate over that section of the legislation became ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which was signed into law in 1980. So ANILCA is actually a footnote of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And it represents how powerful the conservationists were in, at first, opposing Alaska Native land settlements. And it's typical for the conservation groups to do that. That's their instinct, is that they historically and continually oppose Alaska Native American Indian rights to our traditional lands. They love us rhetorically and poetically and romantically, you know, but when it comes to our actually being living human beings wanting to have some control over our own destiny and over our traditional lands and waters, they are one of our opponents. They consistently come out in that position. And I think that's often not recognized.
Jacqueline, in years of covering Native issues and hearings over lands, what's your take on the environmental community and their yin and yang sort of relationship with tribes?
Well, I was working at KTOO there in Juneau in the 1990s, and the Tongass National Forest, the U.S. Forest Service, every 10 years issued a land management plan for the Tongass National Forest. And you had Sea Alaska and the village corporations wanting to log in the Tongass. And then you had the conservationists who didn't want logging to occur, especially logging of old growth, the biggest, oldest trees. And then some of the tribes and tribal people were speaking out against logging. And what they were saying is, we'd rather have salmon and deer than dividends. And so this was one of those instances where some of the natives were aligned with environmentalists, but it was, if you went to the public hearings on the Tongass Land Management Plan and at the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly, they had to vote on different aspects of what their position was going to be. And I'll tell you, people in Juneau know how to talk at these public hearings. They know how to turn out in force and pack the room and testify. And this happened over the Tongass Land Management Plan, and it also happened over mining projects or in Juneau or near Juneau. And so I covered a lot of meetings where there'd be dozens of people who testified, and I'd be at the station late at night trying to summarize what they said and, you know, make sure that several perspectives were included in the story. It was really hard reporting. The other thing that was hard about it was that when I say Juneau people know how to talk, they also know how to call the radio station and say, I didn't like that story you ran last night. And it seems to me you gave too much time and attention to this side as opposed to my side. So it was an interesting time. I mean, I'll tell you, covering local issues is some of the most important and most interesting kind of reporting you can do. So it was a real education.
It is an education, and ANCSA is a huge education in and of itself, because I think that there are very few people in our state that truly understand it. I do want to play one excerpt from the documentary of David Case. He was an attorney, and he's written a couple of books about the land claims fight. David Case talks about the odds of Alaska Natives being able to come out ahead, to actually win this battle and get something that would benefit them, were not very good. We'll talk about this on the other side.
And historically, whatever the Aboriginal property has been reduced to an individual property right, the result has been the massive loss of Aboriginal lands. those who do not know history are doomed to repeat it. And that is likely to happen here in Alaska unless something is done.
I'd like to pull another clip from this documentary. This one is from Stuart Udall, who, when he was U.S. Interior Secretary, stepped right into the middle of the land claims fight by imposing a land freeze in Alaska. In other words, it prevented the state from selecting lands that it received its statehood. So let's listen, and we'll talk about the impact that had on the other side.
I remember it was a very exciting moment because they said you're going to have to stick your neck out and you're going to do something very controversial. And I did that by signing an order and saying the state of Alaska cannot select any more land until the rights of the natives are determined. And, of course, all hell broke loose at that point.
Jocelyn, when you hear Stuart Udall talk about the land freeze, do you think that ANCSA would have ever happened without the land freeze?
I would bet a lot of money no. Natives had been objecting to protesting the taking of their lands since the 1800s. I mean, the Treaty of Cession, when Russia sold Alaska to the United States, and the Organic Act in the 1800s that established government in Alaska, and then the Territorial Act, the Statehood Act, they all said something to the effect of natives will remain undisturbed in the land that they use and occupy, and that will be resolved. You know, their claims will be resolved by the federal government. So if you think about it, from 1867 on, natives were saying, and sometimes at war, the Tlingit fought off Russians over Russian claims to land in Sitka. And so natives had been trying to get a settlement of their land claims all that time, and it didn't happen until the land freeze was imposed. And it's because all of a sudden, the oil companies, the state, the environmentalists, a whole bunch of other people with a lot more power than Alaska Natives, they were at the table and they were saying, okay, we've got to fix this because we can't get what we want unless it gets resolved.
So how pivotal in your mind is the land freeze to making ANCSA a reality?
Well, I just don't think it would have happened without it. The natives would have kept saying, stop, you can't take our land. And everybody else would have been saying, go away. We have our axe to grind. We have our goals. We have the things we want to get done. And as long as they were able to get those things done without native involvement, without resolving land claims, they never would have taken it up.
Paul, what are your thoughts about the land freeze? Without it, would ANCSA have happened?
I think Stuart Udall's freezing or stopping the state continuing to select lands under the Statehood Act was crucial in forcing the state to actually address Alaska Native land claims. So it was a very important moment in the process that eventually resulted in a land claim settlement. We have to understand that ANCSA has this sort of five major interests that are involved in creating the legislation. There are different parts of the federal government, the state of Alaska, conservation groups, oil companies, and Alaska Natives. And it's not necessarily in that order, but those are the five major interests. As you read the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, one of the most productive ways of doing it is to ask, well, who benefits from this section of the legislation? And when I finally understood that, that was a real breakthrough in beginning to make sense of what is a very complicated piece of legislation.
So Nellie's series of programs covers a wide span of years, all the way from the pre-land claims fight up until afterwards. And one of the interviews that's done is with Rosita Worrell, who is now president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Rosita Worrell is a cultural anthropologist, and at the time she was asked to do a study. So in this documentary, she's talking about the social impacts of ANCSA. So let's take a listen to that. She talks about ANCSA creating a class of haves and have-nots.
I would say that there are some people who are adapting very well. We just finished a study in one of the regions, and it's just very clear that there has been this institutional socialization that has occurred. The individuals who took over the land claims or the corporations had the best opportunity to become educated to a corporate system and to a capital system. And I think that they did very well. But then at the other level, of course, I get back to, you know, Native people at the grassroots level. And there, again, we see a disparity. They haven't taken to corporations as well. They don't identify with it. It is an alien institution. They see it separating and dividing their people.
What strikes you about those words that were said then compared to how things are now?
Well, Dr. Rosita Wuerl has a PhD in anthropology, and I believe her dissertation was on subsistence and the importance of subsistence to the Inupiaq people. And so here she's talking about the transition of people from have-nots to haves, and also the disparity in that not all of the Native corporation leadership was able to bring their corporation to the haves side of the equation. One of the barriers to success was, I mentioned earlier, the corporations didn't get their land for decades. There was a shortage of people with any kind of financial background. I mean, I look at the board of Sea Alaska, and there were local leaders, people who had served in positions of leadership on the municipal level, and then there were store owners. And there were no titans of finance. There were no financiers. You know, when all of a sudden you have millions and millions of dollars, it takes a certain kind of background and understanding and knowledge to be able to manage that, to make it profitable. The other thing is that con artists just swarmed all the corporations immediately after they started getting their money. And some of them were very clever, and they were able to con corporations out of some of their funding.
Rosita talks about this class of haves and have-nots forming within the Alaska Native community.
So some of the corporations did not have resources to develop. So the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, because of the oil on the North Slope, has always been able to make good money. And Sea Alaska made good money for a long time from timber. But you look at Calista, and now there are mining projects that are in the works. But for a long time, those weren't getting exploited the way they are now. And so there wasn't any way for Calista to make money except through financing. And that's a hard row to hoe. So some of the corporations made money and some didn't. The haves and have-nots within the Native community were not just on a regional level, though. They were also on the personal level, in the sense that if you went to work for the corporation, if you got on the board of directors and that sort of thing, especially now where, I mean, actually, it's been going on for a long time, where the CEOs and vice presidents are paid in the hundreds of thousands of dollars annually, and they get bonuses. And I mean, I know of at least one who was paid $1 million a year plus bonuses. And people with that kind of wealth just didn't exist in the Native community in the 60s and early 70s. So there's that kind of a have and have not situation as well.
Do we still have haves and have nots today?
Absolutely. I mean, there are parts of the state that are every bit as poor as Mississippi. And the Government Accounting Office years ago did a study. A program was created, the Small Business Administration 8A program, that gave Alaska Natives preferential treatment in the bidding for federal contracts. And the EAC Corporation out of Cordova, I think, contracted with some people who were based in Virginia outside of Washington, D.C., and those people were caught paying kickbacks to U.S. Army Corps of Engineers procurement officers. And the GAO, the Government Accounting Office, did a series of reports on the matter. Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri called for the studies. And basically what they said was you have people who are poverty stricken, and then you have these people who are working for the corporation who have access to enormous wealth. And so there's still that disparity.
When you look at this documentary, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which we are airing, what are your thoughts about that when you look at that sweep of things that it covers?
Well, it's a remarkable, remarkable era. It has completely transformed the state of Alaska. I think it's a tenth of the land in the state now is in Native hands. And like Paul mentioned earlier, the conservation units, the national parks and preserves, wildlife refuges, all of those were created as a result of ANCSA. And it just changed the dynamics enormously. It gave the corporations a lot of clout. I always think of when Senator Lisa Murkowski lost in the primary to someone to the right of her. And she was out of the race as far as the common wisdom said. Nobody wins as a write-in candidate. And she was pretty much out of the race. And then the Native Corporation stepped up and said, look, we'll donate $1 million to your campaign. And they turned the experience that they had in reaching out to their shareholders, they turned that towards helping Lisa Murkowski get reelected. And the next AFN, as I recall, was in Fairbanks, and she gave a very moving speech crediting natives with keeping her in office. So that's something corporations can do. They also have been very adept at lobbying Congress to get laws passed. And sometimes it's amendments to laws that benefit them financially. And so the corporations really changed the dynamics of Alaska.
So just in wrapping things up, what is going through your mind as so many discussions about the 50-year milestone take place?
The key issue is that we are not adequately addressing urban Alaska Natives as we go forward. That's over half of our population now. There's been this major shift, and we are not educating the next generation of people who are going to inherit and are inheriting a series of very important decisions and issues as we go forward. We have to develop a sense that ANCSA is more than dividends. We have to develop some sense that it's more than a monetary issue. It's more about what it means to participate in contributing to our tribal communities. And I don't think that's something that is being addressed sufficiently. And without that, it all just washes away.
Jacqueline, what are your feelings on this milestone of the 50th anniversary?
Well, I think it's an exciting time. You know, there have been milestones before, and there have been events to commemorate and talk about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, but there's more attention this anniversary than there has been in the past. And I think it's a great time for people to learn about ANCSA. If you look at the history of Alaska, there's the Treaty of Cession when Russia sold Alaska, there's the Statehood Act, and then there's ANCSA. And that is followed by the Alaskan National Interest Lands Conservation Act. So those are four fundamental laws that have completely changed the history of Alaska. And so it's important for people, I think, to know that, to know how it's shaped their world.
Indeed. Maybe this is something that we can get into in a future program. But for now, we hope that this program has opened the door to learning more about ANCSA. Jacqueline Estes and Paul Ongtuguk, we hope to have you back as this series continues. Goyana, Gunashish, Anabasi, Taku. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. And be sure to catch ANCSA at 50. The journey continues Thursday nights at 8:00.